Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, first of all, a lovely thank you to everybody who came to Royce Hall on Friday night and McCabe's Saturday night, last night, to see these shows that Judith Owen and I were in, the Cabaret of Souls with Richard Thompson's Cabaret of Souls Friday night and Judith Owen's own show Saturday night. And you missed them? Really? Okay. Come to London for the Christmas show, December 3rd, early warning. If you want to fly, and more about that, of course, moments from now. But first, on the subject of HD radio. Dear Harry, from Robert, I am the other HD radio listener of your show. Initially, I was pleased at the reduced static in the HD signals. Most of the station signals have gotten worse over the past year, causing the broadcast signal to stop until it's reacquired, sometimes taking minutes. I am listening to this week's show via podcast. Cheers, Robert. That's the future, ladies. The digital wonderland, reacquiring in minutes for your listening pleasure. News of the godly, after decades of fierce opposition to the use of all contraception, the Pope will end the Catholic Church's absolute ban on the use of condoms. It's a different kind of infallible. He will say that it's acceptable to use a prophylactic when the sole intention is to reduce the risk of infection from AIDS. So check your intentions, please, before, you know. While he will restate the Catholic Church's staunch objections to contraception, he will argue that using a condom to preserve life and avoid death can be a responsible act even outside marriage. Holy mackerel. And hold the mackerel. And news of NATO's plan to wind down. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've been noticing with interest here on the broadcast for pretty much since President Obama laid down the 2011 deadline that it's more dead than deadline. But here is the most cogent and recent reaffirmation. NATO's plan to wind down its combat mission in Afghanistan by 2015, notice the little slip in years there, is not set in stone. That's according to alliance leaders at the Lisbon summit. This cast doubt on David Cameron, the British Prime Minister's fixed deadline for a British withdrawal. Alliance leaders met in Lisbon, agreed a timetable to transfer responsibility for security to Afghan forces, process due to start next year and conclude by the end of 2014. There's your 2015. Starts right after that. The NATO timetable remains conditional, dependent upon the ability of the Kabul government to secure the country against the Taliban. And more about how that's going later in this broadcast. As the summit began, the Obama administration made clear that 2014 was only, now, dig this, quote, an aspirational goal. We're there. We are so there, unless we're out of there. And NATO's Secretary General warned the West must remain committed in Afghanistan, quote, as long as it takes. Let's see, how long did it take the Russians to... How long did it take the British to... Okay, how long did it... A senior NATO official also warned of inevitable setbacks in the work to complete transition by the end of 2014 and said the question of whether combat operations would be over by then depends on your definition of the word combat. Yes, we're right there again. Hello, welcome to the show.
Every time I feel this way, pick up my guitar and sing a song of Broadway lines. Ego, I'm the song. I often feel I'm sailing, but I always miss the boat. And every time I feel this way, I pick up my guitar. Now you know, so do I. Nothing's wrong.
Hello, Emmett. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, let's talk about the F-bomb, the other F-bomb, foreclosure. Just in case you really haven't been keeping track, and why would you? Very little about this yet on the, yak shows. This is from the Congressional Oversight Panel that released its report this week on the subject of the foreclosure mess, the F-bomb. And here's the a bit of the executive summary to sort of just tell us where we're at. In the fall of 2000, in this fall, reports began to surface alleging that companies servicing $6.5 trillion, think of it, in American mortgages may have bypassed legally required steps to foreclose on a home. This is the robo-signing stuff. These allegations have given rise to ongoing federal and state investigations. The ultimate implications remain unclear. It's possible, however, that robo-signing may have concealed much deeper problems, says the congressional panel, in the mortgage market that could potentially threaten financial stability and undermine the government's efforts to mitigate the foreclosure crisis. The panel urges Treasury and bank regulators to take immediate steps to understand and prepare for the potential risks. In the best-case scenario, concerns about mortgage documentation irregularities may prove overblown. The worst-case scenario is considerably grimmer. In this view, which has been articulated by academics and homeowner advocates, robo-signing of affidavits serve to cover up the fact that loan servicers cannot demonstrate the facts required to conduct a lawful foreclosure. In essence, banks may be unable to prove they own the mortgage loans they claim to own. Letting that sink in for just a moment. The risk stems from the possibility that the rapid growth of mortgage securitization outpaced the ability of the legal and financial system to track mortgage loan ownership. In earlier years, under the traditional model, a homeowner borrowed money from a single bank and then paid back the same bank. In the rare instances when the bank transferred its rights, the sale was recorded by hand in the county property office. Thus, the ownership of any individual mortgage could be easily demonstrated. Nowadays, a single mortgage loan may be sold dozens of times between various banks across the country. In the view of some market participants, the sheer speed of the modern mortgage market has rendered obsolete the traditional ink and paper recordation process. So, the financial industry developed an electronic transfer process that bypasses county property offices. This electronic process has, however, faced legal challenges that could, in an extreme scenario, call into question the validity of 33 million mortgage loans. Let me just interrupt the executive summary from the Congressional Oversight Panel to say one advantage of what the mortgage industry has done by recording these transfers electronically is since they don't enter handwritten records in local county property offices, they don't have to pay transfer taxes each time the mortgage is sold. That's a nice thing. Further, now back to the report, the financial industry now commonly bundles the rights to thousands of individual loans into a mortgage-backed security. This process is complicated and requires several properly executed transfers. If at any point the required legal steps are not followed to the letter, then the ownership of the mortgage loan could fall into question. Homeowner advocates have alleged that frequent robo-signing of ownership affidavits may have concealed extensive industry failures to document mortgage loan transfers properly. The consequences could be severe. Clear and uncontested property rights are the foundation of the housing market. If these rights fall into question, that foundation could collapse. Some servicers dealing with the Treasury's Home Affordable Modification Program may have no legal right to initiate foreclosures, which may call into question their ability to grant modifications or to demand payment from homeowners. That's from the Congressional Oversight Panel. One of the witnesses testifying in front of two congressional investigations into the F-bomb this week pointed out that mortgage servicers are owned, in most cases, by the large banks which either originated the crappy loans or bought the companies like Countrywide that originated the crappy loans. And so there are several conflicts of interest inherent in all this. If there's a problem with the paperwork way back in the originating trail of the mortgage, the servicer might be put in the position of having to, in order to enforce investors' rights, sue its own parent company. You know how that is going to work out. And in many cases, this electronic registry of homeownership that the industry developed called MERS, you'll hear more about that in the coming weeks and months, I'm sure, it has almost no employees. It's basically just a bunch of, you know, computers sitting somewhere. It has, I think, between 12 and 20 employees. And yet, it signs off on thousands and thousands and thousands of transfers of mortgages from one bank to another all the time. How does it do that? Simple. It just says, it sells its own seal for $25 on the internet, and anybody in a mortgage servicing operation can style themselves a vice president of MERS, and does, and signs on behalf of MERS, even though they never received a check from MERS. Cool, isn't it? Nice little thing going on. Calling Dr. Ponzi. Now, from the Washington Post, given the fact that Congress is already digging into this, and the digging looks good, the financial services industry has launched an aggressive campaign on Capitol Hill to lobby, to bolster the legality of the way the companies have turned mortgages into securities and traded them across the globe. The companies have opened wide their wallets for lobbying and are flying top executives to Washington for one-on-one meetings with lawmakers. They're holding briefings for key staffers, including an event last week that drew more than 60 aides, blanketing Congress with white papers, memos, and other documents. The focal point of their efforts is the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, or MERS. Controversial, privately run electronic database that's used by practically every lending institution to track the transfer of the ownership of mortgages as they are packaged into securities. In the vast majority of mortgage documents at local courts and offices around the country, MERS is listed as the holder of the loans. That allows the financial industry to trade mortgages as much as it wishes without spending the time and money to refile the paperwork. That is to say, depriving your county of legally due property transfer fees. The industry, though, is seeking legislation that would effectively affirm MERS's legality. Nothing like post facto affirmation of legality, ladies and gentlemen, and would block any bill that would call into question what MERS does. MERS has spent more than $1 million in lobbying since 2 years ago when lower courts around the country began to rule against it. But MERS had kept its name under the radar until recently. Now, radar blips, MERS. If successful on Capitol Hill, the industry could in one quick swoop make all lawsuits related to MERS across the country moot. That would be some good mootin'. And remove one of the key uncertainties dangling over the mortgage industry. On the flip side, lawmakers could create a new federal registry for mortgages, effectively killing MERS's business and forcing the industry to commit to submit to greater oversight. Well, we wouldn't want that, would we? Oversight? That's a good thing. That means we overlook things. In recent years, MERS has become the target of numerous legal challenges from homeowners in foreclosure who allege that mortgage transfers made through the system are invalid because they bypass local recording laws. MERS does not have standing to foreclose, say the lawsuits, because it's only a database and not the actual holder of the mortgage. The liabilities could be astronomical for MERS. One lawsuit in California alone seeking recording fees costing the company between $60 and $120 billion. But the consequences for the financial industry are even greater. Challenges to the validity of transfers done by MERS call into question the entire process of how loans were securitized and could render the 66 million mortgages in its system foreclosure-proof. Next step, the investors who bought mortgage-backed securities come knocking. Well, no, they send their lawyers knocking, saying, hey, those securities weren't backed by real mortgages because you didn't own them. And then the banks go where? Well, to you and me for rescue. In the wake of such controversies, lobbies for Reston, Virginia-based MERS Corp., which runs MERS, have been floating the idea of legislation that would establish MERS as the national registry to track the transfer of mortgages, or track the transfer. The MERS database is a powerful tool that can be harnessed by the Congress and the industry to improve the mortgage finance business, says MERS Corp's chief executive. There's a lot of validity in the idea of a national mortgage registry that is complete and unambiguous about legal title to loans across all 50 states, says Tom Deutsch of the American Securitization Forum. States' rights? Antiquated. The forum argued that although there have been several minority decisions in the courts that have taken issue with MERS, not one of these decisions has challenged MERS' ability to act as a central system to track changes in the ownership. MERS, it's on your radar now, ladies and gentlemen. It might be a wise idea to keep it there. Especially if you're a homeowner who's got a mortgage that might be foreclosed. Who knows? But now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
A bumper crop of apologies for your listening pleasure. Let's get to them. Dateline Orchard Park, New York. Buffalo Bills rookie running back C.J. Spiller apologized this week before practice for using a derogatory term toward gays on his Twitter account. He used the word Wednesday while exchanging tweets with former Clemson teammate Ricky Sapp. The original tweet has been deleted. Spiller says he hasn't heard from the league yet. He's apologized to head coach Chan Gailey and general manager Buddy Nix. That's what a great name for a sports general manager, Buddy Nix. I want that. Next time. Representative Charles Rangel was convicted of 11 ethics violations this week by a jury of his congressional peers. Then Thursday, he apologized. Today, he said, I stood before the Ethics Committee to apologize for the embarrassment I have brought upon this body that I love dearly and to the members of Congress and to my family and constituents. There's no excuse for my acts of omission and failures to abide by the rules of Congress. I've made many mistakes I will forever regret. And I apologize for them. To my beloved colleagues, my constituents, and the American people, I am sorry. Not an if in the bunch. Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg apologized for a bug that accidentally deleted accounts on Facebook for alleged and erroneous violations of its terms of service. An undisclosed number of users were kicked off the service this week, and Zuckerberg apologized. I apologize to those users for that bug. It was not related to Facebook's new messages service. I think we were able to get them back on the site. See, he worked in a plug into the apology for the bug. Fox News chief Roger Ailes apologized to the Anti-Defamation League for calling National Public Radio executives Nazis. Ailes made a comment in an interview with the Daily Beast's Howard Kurtz regarding recent controversies. Ailes hired Juan Williams full-time after NPR fired him. Ailes also said left-wing rabbis make it difficult to use the word Holocaust on the air. On Thursday, Ailes issued an apology to the ADL. He wrote he was sorry for using the term Nazi. I was, of course, ad-libbing and should not have chosen that word, but I was angry at the time because of NPR's willingness to censor Juan Williams for not being liberal enough. The ADL's national director, Abraham Foxman, accepted the apology. He said he called it as sincere as it is heartfelt. Aren't those synonyms? Is good as it is, fine. While I wish Roger had never invoked that terminology, said Abraham Foxman of ADL, I appreciate his efforts to immediately reach out and retract his words before they did any further harm. Now, all we need is Jerry Seinfeld to apologize for the soup Nazi, and everything is cool. An Oak Park, Illinois pastor who made sympathetic remarks about women joining the Roman Catholic priesthood has apologized to his congregation after reportedly being told to do so by his bishop. The the Reverend Larry McNally, pastor of Ascension Parish, caused a stir a couple months ago when he signed a petition expressing solidarity with those who support women and married men who are called to ordination. Auxiliary Bishop John Manns met with McNally and told him he wanted a public apology and a pledge not to challenge church doctrine, said an anonymous church source. Fearing he would be stripped of his job, McNally decided to apologize in a letter published in the church bulletin. Quote, "I am sorry that my words and actions may have caused some upset and some inner turmoil among our parish family." Deadline Cheyenne, Wyoming. Governor Dave Freudenthal has apologized for using profanity when talking about his administration's preparations for turning things over to his successor, Governor-elect Matt Mead. Freudenthal's office inadvertently released unedited recordings of the governor talking about his proposed state budget. In the recordings, he says his administration is covering Mead's ass and says he doesn't believe Mead understands that. Freudenthal issued a statement later that day saying, "For the choice of words and the incredibly inappropriate language, I am deeply sorry and recognize the responsibility is entirely my own." Okay. In the wake of an ABC News investigation into the Better Business Bureau's controversial grading system, the national president of the BBB has apologized to consumers and business owners for, quote, errors, unquote. BBB leaders met this week in a special session to discuss reforms to the system. The BBB is being accused by some in the business community, as well as the Connecticut Attorney General, of running a scheme in which A-plus ratings are only awarded to those who pay membership fees, and low grades given to those who don't. German software giant SAP has apologized to Oracle for the conduct of one of its subsidiaries. The apology came in court testimony of Chief Executive Bill McDermott about the attempt of SAP's Tomorrow Now unit to use unlicensed Oracle software to win maintenance clients away from Oracle. SAP has admitted wrongdoing in the case. The courtroom apology on Monday was the first that SAP has made in the high-profile case. McDermott said buying Tomorrow Now was a mistake and apologized to Oracle for its conduct. "I believe we entered into the Tomorrow Now acquisition too quickly and without enough due diligence," he was quoted as saying. "I am sorry." Here were saps. Last week, two erroneous notices were emailed to a portion of U.S. Mint customers who had subscribed to automatically receive Mount Hood National Park quarter rolls and bags and the coveted 2010 Silver Eagle proof. The initial email indicated their product had been placed on back order. The second email said their order was canceled as the product had sold out. The Mint confirmed that approximately 100,000 orders were impacted by the snafu. Who knew there were still that many coin collectors? On Thursday, a third email went out saying the back-order subscription items canceled were an error. They sincerely apologized for the confusion and the inconvenience. They sent out a fourth email, again apologizing and reassuring customers that their 2010 Silver Eagle Proof orders were reinstated. Screw it, buy gold from Gordon Liddy. Dateline Ottawa, the Conservative government apologized Thursday for placing government ads on websites with soft porn. No, they didn't want to be on hard. At least two federal agencies in Canada, the National Film Board and Canada Post, were advertising on photo-sharing websites that feature sexually explicit images of women. The Department of National Defense was also advertising on questionable websites such as HollywoodTuna.com, which posts barely clothed celebrities and offers derogatory remarks about them. Kind of like that one. I mean, just the idea of it. National Film Board and Canada Post, which is the post office in Canada, said they had unknowingly advertised there and pledged to be more vigilant. Or vigilant. This week's Catholic clergy apology comes from Ireland. Father Brendan Rixon. Sorry, that's a photo caption I read. Nice photo, though. Archbishop Dermot Clifford has issued an apology to a young man who was sexually abused by a priest. Archbishop Clifford issued the apology after Father Brendan Rixon was convicted of gross indecency against a teenager and received a suspended sentence. The court heard the priest committed the assault while acting as a confessor during a religious workshop. The archbishop said he was deeply sorry. He is administrator of the Diocese of Cloyne. He is deeply sorry that the trust of a young man was abused. He expressed sincere regret to the victim and his family. But was it sincere and heartfelt? That is my question to you, sir, back in Cloyne. David Fleming, author of a book about the legendary Pottsville Maroons, apologized in print this week for failing to inspire Hollywood to turn the football story into a feature film. You can read up on that. Interjit Singh Rayat apologized to the families of Air India victims and expressed his regrets in an emotional address in court at the end of a sentencing hearing on a conviction of perjury. He did not spell out in court what he regretted or why he was apologizing. He did not refer to the lies he spoke under oath that led to his conviction for perjury, nor did he reveal any new information about the Air India conspiracy, the most significant unsolved criminal case in Canadian history. And one that you can read about on a soft porn site, apparently. Dateline Edmonton, Alberta Health Services President Stephen Duckett has apologized for refusing to discuss emergency care because he was eating a cookie. But critics are still demanding changes and calling for his firing. Duckett wouldn't talk to reporters following a meeting this week on ways to ease hospital overcrowding and long waits for emergency treatment in the Alberta medical system, saying repeatedly, "I'm eating my cookie. Can't you see I'm eating my cookie?" On his blog later, he indicated he deeply regrets his poor response to the media. "We are all striving to do our best, but I know we got it wrong this time. Please accept this apology. I have this cookie." No, he did not say that. Joe Scarborough, a host of MSNBC's Morning Joe, and the namesake thereof, was briefly suspended Friday after the magazine Politico uncovered donations he had made to political candidates. Donations to friend and family members totaled $2,000. His suspension will keep him off Morning Joe for 2 days. This is the same network that suspended Keith Olbermann for the same offense earlier. In a statement, Scarborough apologized to MSNBC and to anyone who's been negatively affected by my actions. One of college basketball's most underrated in-state rivalries became a little more hostile this week after a student employee put up a boastful message on the post-game scoreboard. As fans filed out following BYU's hard-fought victory over visiting Utah State, the message flashed, "Dear Utah State, enjoy the loss. Your big brother, BYU." BYU issued a statement the next day apologizing for the scoreboard message and insisting the student acted without the knowledge of anyone from the athletic department. The university is extremely sorry for this message, which does not reflect the sentiment of BYU athletics or the university. Athletics does not operate the scoreboard in the Marriott Center. The British Prime Minister's enterprise advisor, Lord Young, was forced to issue a groveling apology this week after he claimed most Britons, quote, had never had it so good during this so-called recession, unquote. He was later invited to resign, and he did so. Bristol Palin posted a brief apology on Facebook this week after 16-year-old sister Willow used anti-gay slurs to attack a classmate who criticized the family's reality show. "Ha ha, you're so gay," wrote Willow. "Sorry that you guys are all jealous of my family's success and you guys aren't going to go anywhere with your lives." She is being raised right. Bristol also weighed into the debate, but later had a change of heart. "Willow and I shouldn't have reacted to negative comments about our family. We apologize. P.S. Please vote for me. I'm dancing with this." No, she didn't have the P.S. The British Energy Secretary Chris Huhne has apologized for 40 years' worth of clandestine illegal mutilation of the corpses of British nuclear energy workers. When these workers died, pathologists and coroners colluded with the Energy Authority to remove their organs without the consent or knowledge of their families, in part to remove the possibility of a lawsuit for cancer caused by their work environment. But partly out of a seeming cavalier better safe than sorry approach that had them scooping out organs that had no diagnostic value. The corpses were then stuffed with random detritus from around the shop to disguise their mutilation. For example, broomsticks were used in place of bones removed from workers who died of leukemia. Quote, "The part played by these public servants should be a particular concern to us all, because they listened to the representatives of the UK nuclear organizations rather than taking into account the concerns of the families and the interests of society as a whole. The coroners and pathologists in particular should have been impartial, but they not only let down these families, they sometimes deceive them." Unquote. The apology of UK Energy Secretary Chris Huhne. You know, it's just clean, safe, cheap thing. Airdrie United Football Club's Remembrance Day program, this was in Scotland, featured Nazi soldiers. The shocking image was used on the cover of its magazine for a Division II clash against Livingston. They thought, said club officials, it showed Australian soldiers. The words on the photo were, "Lest we forget," and "supporting our heroes." They apologized. And in a related matter, paging Roger Ailes, France's state-run railroad has for the first time expressed, quote, "sorrow and regret," unquote, for its role in the deportation of Jews during World War II. But the mea culpa is confined to its English language website and part of a bid to secure a lucrative rail contract in Florida. And one more football apology. This year is rife with football apologies. Good on you, mates. Kansas City Chiefs coach Todd Haley apologized at his news conference for refusing to shake the hand of his Denver counterpart after Kansas City lost to the Broncos last week. "I do believe in doing what's right, and that was not right," Haley said. "I probably let the emotions of the situation get me too much. I apologize to the fans and to Denver and to Josh. It wasn't the right thing to do." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
We thank Frank Sinatra Jr. for calling in last segment with his good wishes. We didn't have time to take Mickey Rooney Jr.'s call on the air, but we're going to play back on the weekend show this Saturday night on CNN. With us now in our Los Angeles studio is an old friend of this show. He's the former lead singer of the great boy band of the 90s, Boys R Us, Dewey Gordon. Dewey, welcome back to what may be your last visit to Larry King Live.
Oh, bite your tongue, Mr. King, and of course I don't mean that.
No, it sounded like I'd had a stroke or something. Now, last time you were on the show, your group was reuniting.
That's right. I'd shaved my head to get back into the Boys R Us spirit, yeah. Although none of the other guys did, which was a surprise to me.
Was that a stunt they were playing on you?
No, I think my outgoing message was just stuck in their spam filter.
So as everybody can see, you're growing your hair back.
Yes, sir.
Which is something I wish I could do.
Yes, sir. The reunion thing was a great idea. Yeah. The feeling in that studio for those 75 minutes was real, real special. But, you know, the great Mr. Nate Pendleman.
He's your longtime handler.
He only did that a couple. He's our longtime manager, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And he looked over the touring concert scene this summer.
And it's been rough out there here. The great John Tesh, he always plays Red Rocks. He told me they downsized the venue for his show. He only played the Three Rocks.
Yes, sir. So anyway,
hey, after September, only person can do that material for is my wife.
Oh, please give her my love.
You can do it yourself if you...
Mr. Pendleman said he thought this wasn't the primo year for the reunion. And Chuchi had gotten his cab driving slot back anyway, so we'll see what happens. But I didn't want to come on your show tonight to talk about me, Mr. King.
Now that's a switch.
Sure, and it's overdue. I wanted to talk about you.
Hey, I got a lot of life in me yet. Got a lot of soccer games go to, just to make sure.
That he kicks the ball, gotcha. But you've been so special to me, always, helping out when I had a record to promote.
Yeah, Nate Pendleman and I go way back. The old Brooklyn days. He used to fence stolen hubcaps.
You know, he's told us some of those stories.
Every word is true. I was there. I bought a couple of hubcaps off him.
Well, then you'll understand how I felt when he hustled me into the studio and allowed me to record a song he'd had written for this very sad moment when... Well, we're having to look at a time when the only place we can see your TV show is in an actual museum.
You didn't write this one yourself.
Mr. King, let me level with you. The best songwriters in the world are only a phone call away.
Yeah.
Not my call, of course.
And this is a song about what? This show?
It's about that. It's about you and so much more. It's about learning to say goodbye, really, if you stop and think about it.
Well, let's just listen to it. The great Dewey Gordon. What's the name of the song?
Who Can I Talk To Tonight? This is for Larry. Who can I talk to? Where can I go when I need to be on somebody's show? Where questions have answers that you don't need to know? Who can I talk to tonight? You weren't aggressive. You didn't probe. You never tried to rip open the robe. Just a mic and a camera. No need for a strobe. Who can I talk to tonight? Queen Latifah. Donald Trump and Roger Moore. OJ and MJ helped your kingdom grow. Little old me and H. Ross Perot. Didn't read her book, didn't hear my song. Just a guy from Brooklyn, free to get things wrong. How could something so simple go on for so long? And who can I talk to tonight? Politics and showbiz, chatting with pals. Then daily breakfasts at Nate and Al's. We changed presidents. You changed wives, and through it all, Who can replace you? Why even try? Who else could make heart attacks a reason to buy? I'm still eating garlic just so I don't cry. Who can I talk to tonight? Yeah. Who can I talk to tonight? Who can I talk to tonight?
The great Dewey Gordon. Who can I talk to tonight? You know something? I'm asking myself the same question. Of course, the answer is my lovely wife. I love you, sweetheart.
Thanks, Mr. King, but I just had to share.
I was talking to Sean. Dewey, the song was very moving. What is it, on your website?
You know, we're talking about that. Apparently, we're a little behind on the upkeep details, but the first 140 characters of it will definitely be on my Twitter page.
The great Dewey Gordon, thanks so much, pal. Means a lot to me. Tomorrow night, Barry Scheck for the full hour.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's too cheap to be clean and safe to meter. Yeah, I got that right. Dateline Berwick, Pennsylvania, a preliminary white finding signifying low to moderate safety concerns is included in the most recent report for the Susquehanna Nuclear Power Plant by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The reports come after flooding in July. You don't mean in July, do you? Forced PPL to shut down Unit 1 at the plant for about 20 days. An estimated 950,000 gallons of Susquehanna River water flooded the basement of the plant's turbine building. The water flowed from hatches that access the unit's condenser where the river water cools steam, leaving the turbine. The quarterly inspection report specifically points to inadequate installation instructions for a condenser water box gasket, which caused the problem. Response to the flooding was, quote, complicated and delayed, unquote, because of an incorrect diagram that was used to find and isolate the leak and the lack of specific instructions for isolating a leak with the condenser water boxes. Yeah, it's advanced technology, ladies and gentlemen, and a gasket can produce a moderate safety concern. The NRC uses a color code system to indicate safety risks, green for low, followed by white. With a white finding, the NRC would initiate additional oversight and inspections for the Susquehanna plant. The leak was significant, and while it did not affect the plant's nuclear operations, it did affect important cooling operations. And if it ain't cool, it goes, but clean and safe and cheap. And now, ladies and gentlemen, tales of airport security. You want to strap in for this one. First of all, from Richard. Dear Harry, at the end of September, I returned home to Austin from a brief visit to Santa Cruz, where I hung out with a friend's wine buddies. On the last day of my visit, we went to a vineyard and picked grapes for several hours. The next day, I went to Oakland Airport for my return home to Austin. I have an implanted cardiac device, so I have to be hand-searched rather than going through the usual machines. After my pat-down, I was led to a back corner of the inspection area. The person who searched me had come up with a positive for explosives. I've never been close to explosives in my life, so it came as a surprise to me. The supervisor and the inspector ran the explosive test again. Once again, it came up positive. Nearly an hour later, my plane's loading time looming, the airport's explosive expert finally absolved me and let me go to my gate. Trouble seems to have been that I had naturally occurring nitrates. This was an organic vineyard, which had been absorbed in my shoes the previous day. The explosive expert suggested that I not wear any shoes that I had used for any sort of gardening. Now I know. And now to other matters involving airport security. Yes, the media are full of stories about groping. Ladies and gentlemen, groping is, for now, radiation is forever. Full body scanners are a waste of money. That's why we haven't put them in our airport, said Raif Sela, former chief security officer of the Israeli Airport Authority and a 30-year veteran in airport security and defense technology, who helped design the security at Israel's Ben Gurion Airport, which has some of the toughest security in the world. He told Canadian MPs that he wouldn't reveal how to get past the virtual strip search scanners, but said he can provide briefings Canada this year bought 44 of the scanners for major Canadian airports. Saylor testified it makes more sense to create a trusted traveler system so pre-approved low-risk passengers can move through an expedited process, leaving more resources in the screening areas where automatic sniffing technology would detect any explosive residue on person or their baggage. Behavioral profiling must also be used instead of random checks, he said. Having a random search at the airport is like Russian roulette, he said. And U.S. scientists warned this week, according to Agence France-Presse, that the full-body graphic image X-ray scanners may be unsafe. They say the risk is minimal, but statistically someone is going to get skin cancer from these X-rays, said Dr. Michael Love at Johns Hopkins. Canadian scanners rely on different technology that doesn't pose a health risk to travelers. Interesting. Full-body X-ray scanner technology used in the U.S. is not permitted in Canada. Canadian scanners use millimeter wave technology. The security boss of Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport is calling for an end to endless investment in new technology to improve airport security. Maren Ornstein said, if you look at all the recent terrorist incidents, the bombs were detected because of human intelligence, not because of screening. If even a fraction of what is spent on screening was invested in the intelligence services, we would take a real step toward making air travel safer and more pleasant. Only problem is, ex-Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff doesn't work for an agency that sells intelligence services. He works for a company, or actually his consultancy works for a company that sells scanners. Ornstein believes old-fashioned intelligence and smart screening of passengers are the way forward, much like the Israeli expert. And the controversial body scanners currently being tested at Hamburg's airport are constantly malfunctioning due to folds in passengers' clothing. Germany's public radio station NDR, please give, said the trial of the body imaging scanners has been plagued by serious problems. They are unable to tell the difference between foreign objects and such things as pleated clothing. They use millimeter wave technology. That's the kind that's used in Canada, so that's why you don't want to see those. So, you know, suck it up and dig those X-rays. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, and I mean now, news from outside the bubble. That's me saying now. Now. A dozen men who accused British security forces of colluding in their transfer overseas for torture are to get millions in compensation from the UK government. Some of the men, who are all British citizens or residents, were detained at Guantanamo Bay. At least six of them alleged British forces were complicit in their torture before they arrived at Guantanamo. The coalition government says it wants to avoid a massive court case, which would also put the British Secret Intelligence Services under the spotlight. The Court of Appeal had rejected the government's pleas to hear secret evidence in secret, and secret material from MI5 and MI6 vaults could have become a flood had the case not been settled. But it does trigger the launch of a judge-led inquiry into complicity and rendition. And Britain says it will stick, this according to The Guardian, to its 2014-15 deadline for ending combat operations in Afghanistan, despite apparent wavering from U.S. and NATO officials over the date. The British people want to see an end to our combat role, says a Downing Street spokeswoman. That would be 2015. Asked whether UK troops would withdraw from combat by the end of 2014, whatever happens, Defense Secretary Liam Fox replied, "We certainly don't want to be in a combat role." And he's the one who added, "But it depends what you mean by combat." General Sir David Richards, the head of British Armed Forces, said the deadline was, quote, "very doable." Okay. But as we've heard before, not set in stone. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now news of the Olympic movement. After several weeks of tense negotiations that nearly led to an all-out legal battle, the troubled Olympic Village in Vancouver has been put into receivership at the request of the city. That gives Vancouver control over how the one-time Olympic Village is marketed and sold. The city reached an agreement with Millennium Development, an agreement that prohibits each side from suing the other over the village. So Millennium pays off the city of Vancouver for an undisclosed figure. Well, those Olympic Villages, they're good business, aren't they? Yes, they are, because it's a movement. And lest we leave some general matters uninspected.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
A federal audit has raised concerns about cleanup delays at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation plant, where workers produced more than half the plutonium for the U.S. The agency's Office of Inspector General raised concerns, the Department of Energy's Inspector General raised concerns that decontaminating and demolishing more than 60 billion buildings at Hanford was behind schedule. The project cost was pegged at $528 million, but the report says the cost has grown to $718 million, a 36% increase, despite receiving $330 million in federal stimulus money to speed up the work. One of every seven Medicare beneficiaries who is hospitalized is harmed as a result of problems with the medical care there, according to the Office of Inspector General for Health and Human Services. The study says unexpected adverse events in hospitals added at least $4 billion a year to government health costs and contributed to the deaths of about 180,000 patients a year. 44% of those adverse incidents are clearly or likely preventable, says the IG. Hospital infections are cited as a major source of problems. Other events are even more common. The most frequent problems classified as adverse events were those related to medication, like excessive bleeding, followed those related to patient care, like intravenous fluid overload, and those related to surgery and infection. The most serious events, like surgery on the wrong patient, amounted to less than 1% of the events tallied, according to the team leader for the Inspector General Study Group. And security training at some federal courthouses is so ineffective it took almost 8 years for some security officers to learn how to turn on the X-ray machine software that would detect guns and explosives, according to a Justice Department audit of courthouse security operations. And the Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security says the agency being TSA, does not have documented standard processes to update training based on current information. TSA screener training not up to snuff. Suck up some X-rays, won't you? News of the Inspector General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. By the way, when I was a kid, there were machines in children's shoe stores that X-rayed children's feet to show whether they had outgrown their shoes. It was cool to put your feet under there. 10 years later, of course, they were outlawed amid shocked expostulations about what could they have been thinking. And what are we thinking? I'm thinking that that's the end of this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a on your smartphone through stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like getting a dose if you agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Just a little dose. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, In Exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and information on the music played hereon, still available, as of this moment, at harryshearer.com. And this broadcast is on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.